Alpine Authors on Park Radio. A look at some of the great books being written by and for the Bow Valley.
Hi, and welcome to Alpine Authors. I'm Alan Buckingham. Canadians always seem to love to talk about the weather, and that isn't likely to change as the climate changes and weather becomes more extreme. Extreme weather is just one of the things Robert William Sanford talks about in his new book, Restoring the Flow, Confronting the World's Water Woes. Bob Sanford is my guest this week on Alpine Authors. Hi, Bob. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure, Alan. Thank you.
Now, your book is about water, not just weather, but reading the book, I find that they're pretty intertwined.
What we'd like to think of now is not isolating water and water resources as something separate in the way we think about the world, but we want to think more and more about larger interfaces between land, water, life, the atmosphere, and our climate. And one of the ways to do that is for us to pay closer attention to what's happening to our water resources.
Now, you've already written a book about water and weather, so what's different with Restoring the Flow?
Restoring the Flow really begins where the earlier book left off. And what it does is it identifies exactly what's happening to water resources, particularly in southern Canada, and why we ought to be paying close attention to those developments. It also tries to tie together what's happening in the rest of the world and to demonstrate how some of the impacts of water scarcity elsewhere will influence the way that we live long before the people who emigrate from those places that are water scarce begin to affect our economy and our society. It's really about what the world's water crisis means in the Canadian context and how we should be responding to it.
And so what made you want to write the book now?
I, over the last 2 years, have discovered some very interesting convergences, and I think that as our global population continues to grow, it should surprise no one that key resources such as water are no longer available in volumes and in the quality that we wish them to be and have been in the past. And I think that what we are seeing now is that potentially the conflict for over water resources will grow in time, especially as our population increases to a projected 9.4 billion. And as our climate change moves precipitation from where people have been historically concentrated to where they are not. And I think that it's important to note that in many parts of the world, cities and agriculture are now competing with nature for water. And as a result, we're beginning to see some very frightening convergences. So we decided now if we wish to give nature the water it needs to continue to sustain planetary life support function and self-regulation, that water is probably going to have to come from agriculture, which means that people will starve. If, on the other hand, we give agriculture the water it needs to keep feeding our growing population, there won't be enough water to allow nature to sustain fundamental functions and self-regulations. And add to that serious groundwater overdraft in many of the area, world's food-producing areas, and the picture doesn't look very good. So we should expect global food and water security to be among the most pressing political issues of our age, and we should anticipate Canada playing an even greater role in agricultural production to help feed growing populations, and we should also expect Canada to be one of the places to which people will come as water scarcity begins to affect other parts of the world.
Now, the notion of giving water to nature is something that comes up a bunch in the book, and it's something that I don't think we've always thought about. Do you find that people think about that, are thinking about that more often?
I think there have been some profound new realizations about hydroecological properties of the planet. And whereas we often thought of our rivers really as pipelines, now we see them really as living sponges floating on top of large natural blotters where water moves in all sorts of ways underneath and adjacent to rivers. We're also beginning to see that as we understand ecological processes better, we know that ecosystems actually generate, capture, purify, and release water all on their own. So emerging eco-hydrological perspectives could become the foundation of a practical new definition of sustainability. And the central tenets of eco-hydrology are breathtakingly simple. And they start with the notion that nature is of survival value to people, and much of its survival value is established through the supply of fresh water. So in order to provide water and other benefits to people, nature needs water too. And it follows hence that nature should be a legitimate water customer in its own right. Nature can't be where we send water as a place of last resort. And if we don't recognize nature's need for water, especially in dry regions, such as those that are downstream and down valley from us here on the east slopes of the Great Divide, there will not in the end be enough water for cities, agriculture, and nature.
In the intro to the book, you introduce the concept of peak water, and people may be familiar with peak oil, the concept that we've sort of hit the end of easily accessible oil and, you know, it's on the decline now. What is peak water?
It's important to understand that there's only a finite amount of water in the world, and that amount of water has remained stationary since the planet came into existence. So we reuse a lot of water. We're using water that creatures in geological epochs before us used. And what we're seeing now is that there may not be enough fresh water in the hydrological system to meet all of the demands that humans put on that water resource when they want that water. And what we're seeing now is our population grows, and so much of human activity is predicated on the use of water for industry, for agriculture, for so many of the things that are meaningful to human existence, that there's tremendous pressure on our world water resources. When I talk about peak water, we don't have any more, and we're using it very, very rapidly and in so many diverse ways, and we're taking so much of it out of commission by polluting it so that it's no longer available for other uses. So when I talk about peak water in the book, what I'm saying is that we ought to be fully cognizant of the limits of our water resources and how quickly we're approaching them with our demands.
At the beginning of the book, you have an invocation. It's rivers within yearn for rivers without. Can you talk a bit about that?
The invocation really is an invitation to the reader to understand how fully and deeply water affects us. It enters our psyche in subtle ways by drinking it, by all the things that we do with it, how we enjoy it and our recreations, and how central it is to our weather and our climate. So when I invoke the notion of the broader sense of water to open the book, what I'm asking the reader to do is to just think how profoundly water and water concerns interpenetrate and interlock with everything that we do, every act that we conduct, and all the things that we make and are related to the availability of water resources. And this is particularly true, although we are less conscious of it in this country, in a place like Canada where our prosperity has been founded in the past on what people have perceived to be quite abundant water resources.
Now, is that invocation something that just came to you one day? It seemed like a very concisely well put, imaginative piece.
Well, you have to remember, Alan, I've been working on water for a long time and thinking about it, and I've had a number of events in my life that have involved water in transformative moments. So I think all of us, if we think deeply about our past experiences, particularly if we live in the Mountain West, water is something that means something to us. So I think that it's possible when you reflect on that to really touch on the poetic aspects of water's influence on our lives, and that's what I hope to do with the beginning of the book.
Now, you've been working in water for a fair bit of time. What are your goals for this book? What are you hoping to get out of this book right now?
First, we want to dispel the myth of limitless abundance of water in Canada. And secondly, we would like to translate new scientific research outcomes into language the average person can understand and act upon, and that decision makers can understand well enough to help them make choices in the development of public policy that will allow us to deal with water issues in a timely way. Finally, we hope through this book to be able to bring international example to bear on the kinds of problems that we are creating for ourselves in Canada that we tend to deny because of this myth of limitless water abundance. We have many water issues that are converging simultaneously upon us, and we're not paying attention to the fact that they are converging in this manner. And my fear, particularly in Western Canada, is that deep and prolonged drought could produce a situation here where all of these unresolved problems become overwhelming to us, and that we will not be able to respond to a crisis like that because there are too many things that we haven't done and should have done in better, more convenient times. I look at what happened to Australia as a result of their prolonged drought, and I see us being vulnerable in exactly the same way. So it's important in my mind to be aware of the types of problems that we've got, recognize some of the things that can be done to resolve some of the bigger issues so that when the inevitable drought, deep and persistent as it will probably be given the historical record of the West, when that eventually happens, that we can survive it and that we don't need to be overwhelmed by the conditions that it imposes upon us.
That's great. And I want to talk a bit about some of those examples that you bring in from around the world. But we got to take a bit of a break here. And when we get back, I'll talk a little bit about that with the author of Restoring the Flow, Robert William Sanford.
Alpine Authors on Park Radio will be right back. Now back to Alpine Authors, only on Park Radio, 101.1 FM.
Hi, and welcome back to Alpine Authors. I'm Alan Buckingham. I'm speaking with Bob Sanford, the author of Restoring the Flow, Confronting the World's Water Woes. Now, I know water is something you've been into for a long time and you're pretty passionate about. How did you get into water?
I became interested in water, of course, when I was quite young because of relationships I had with glaciers and the major rivers of the Mountain West. And I became very interested in water resources in Canada when I was invited to become chair of the United Nations International Year of Mountains in 2002. And during that particular year, we began to look at as mountains as headwaters, as water towers in major regions like the West. And it was then that I began to realize that while water was reasonably well protected inside national and provincial parks, the moment it left, many of the same things that were happening elsewhere in the world to water resources were happening here, and we didn't seem to pay attention to that. The following year, I was invited by Environment Canada to chair Canada's United Nations International Year of Fresh Water. And flowing from that, the United Nations declared a decade of action on the global water crisis, the Water for Life decade. And our many partners who were involved in that initiative across the Canada wanted to make sure that we continued our efforts because it was felt to be worthwhile to have global examples to which to turn when we looked at the types of situations that we were beginning to face in Canada.
And with some of that participation that's taken you around the world so you can see some of the examples that you've brought into your book. Can you talk a bit about some of those examples of water scarcity and case studies that you bring into your book?
It's important to recognize that many, many countries have been where we are now in terms of developing water scarcity. I mean, other countries had relatively abundant water in parts of their countries, but they also recognized that as population growth and agricultural and industrial withdrawals grew, their water resources became under pressure. And it's important to recognize this has happened widely elsewhere and to understand what others have done about it in their situations so we can learn from them. We have looked very carefully at places that are water scarce because we recognize that the eastern slopes of the Rockies, the Canadian Prairies, parts of central British Columbia, and other parts of the countries are becoming increasingly water scarce. And also, where there is even abundance of water, we're beginning to see some of the same problems that occur elsewhere with the deterioration of water quality because of agricultural practices or industrial activities. We're also beginning to see here in a very interesting and dramatic way, the first evidence of what climate change will likely do to water supply and water security in Western Canada. And that, too, is of great interest to us.
Now, you use a few different examples of places that have had some of these issues and things they've done and what they've learned. I'm thinking particularly about in Texas. You went down and learned a bit about some of the situation there and tried to bring that back. What are some of the issues that they've faced in Texas that may be similar to issues we face here in Alberta?
In the Canadian West, we have outmoded, outdated water laws. We tend, particularly in southern Alberta, to rely on first-in-time, first-in-right water licensing programs that grant rights to early users for all the water that they may wish to have within a given license. We find that that particular approach, which was also developed first in the United States, has limitations as your population continues to grow and there's greater need for multiple uses of water, particularly competition from cities and for other users for agricultural water use. By going to Texas, we recognize that something was very different there. They had even more conservative water laws than we do here, more outdated, but they had developed models and mechanisms that allowed them to work around the limitations of their law through cooperation and through collaboration to solve groundwater problems in unique and very interesting ways. And our goal in examining the Texas groundwater example was to be able to show how new computer-assisted real-time modeling systems can allow people to visualize what's happening in surface water and rivers and also what's happening in groundwater aquifers and begin to see the types of pressures that they're applying and their potential impacts in the future. We have been unsuccessful in bringing some of those models to the West because of resistance inherent in our systems, but we have also drawn attention to their availability, their usefulness, their practicality, so that perhaps in the future we can employ these before we need them urgently.
Now, you do a few different case studies, the Texas one, Spain, Australia, but you also talk a bit about how things are going in Canada, and particularly in northern Canada, and how climate change can affect is going to affect water in northern Canada.
Climate change is a fact of life in the Canadian North, and unlike those who live in southern cities who are often oblivious to what climate change is doing to the landscapes and natural processes around them, the people who live in the Mackenzie River Basin, for example, in the Northwest Territories, Aboriginal and otherwise, are close enough to the land to observe what's going on. This fact in itself makes climate change a moral and ethical rather than academic issue among these people. They see it. They live it every day. Moral and ethical issues are only slowly coming to the fore, however, in the climate debate, particularly in southern Canada. And I just want to point out that, and I do this in the book, that one of the first works of note to appear on this subject was a book by James Garvey entitled The Ethics of Climate Change, Right and Wrong in a Warming World. Determination of the morality of a given climate change response, Garvey suggests, might well be founded on notions of justice. And that's a fundamental element of the way we think in the South. And one of the fundamental principles of justice is that harming the innocent is unjust. And the innocent, in the context of the Northwest Territories, could be considered to be those who have not been granted choice or agency in decisions related to how landscapes around them are changing as a result of the impacts of outside others. The people in Canada's north do not generate significant greenhouse gas emissions, but they are subject disproportionately to climate-related impacts. And in the context of what's happening in the Northwest Territories, this makes southern inaction on climate change both immoral and unjust. And the point here is that others are beginning to see through our public relations strategies. If southerners simply deny that climate change impacts exist, then they don't have to face the moral consequences of destroying the landscapes and livelihoods of their northern neighbors. The people of the North know that sustainability demands something from everyone, but it won't be long before they grow weary of being among those of whom great sacrifice is tacitly expected, but to whom few benefits flow. Sooner or later, the unfair distribution of benefits and burdens associated with climate change impacts is going to spark conflict in this country. And in a few months, we'll arrive at an important potential turning point in humanity's response to the climate issue. And if our attitudes and actions with respect to climate change don't change in Canada, the climate conference in Copenhagen could end up being the Munich of our time. And if that happens, our own Arctic, our very own Northwest Territories, could become the Sudetenland of Canada's very own and very nasty little climate war. So I think we need to pay attention to how climate is affecting others. Even though we are less sensitive to it in the South, it's happening in our North.
Now, at the end of the book, you talk about how it seems that people aren't willing to make those choices, make the sacrifices, even though they know they're going to need to long-term, that they're afraid that somebody's going to take advantage of them if they make the sacrifice. Is there hope for us? Do you think we can make the changes that are necessary?
I believe that almost all of the areas of potential problem that are identified in the book can be resolved through patient, mutually respectful collaboration informed by goodwill and sound science. I think we have the capacity to do that. But they won't stay resolved. These issues won't stay resolved unless there are changes in the way we govern ourselves. Of all the potential areas of conflict that exist today related to water and climate, the one that troubles me the most is the failure of governance. And when I speak of governance, what I'm talking about are the principles and standards by which we allow our collective affairs to be managed. And on a global basis, I don't think we appear to be managing our collective affairs very well. And many people to whom I talk are finding it very difficult to believe in a system that's prepared to bring us to the brink of global ecosystem collapse before acting on the requirement to calculate damage to our planetary life support system into pricing, taxation, and the calculation of real domestic product. And others are losing faith in a system that regularly takes it upon itself to plunge future generations into huge debt to perpetuate what many perceive to be a bubble economy. And I think one of the big problems that we face is that we simply refuse to see what's happening right in front of our very eyes with respect to our obsession with limitless growth. And though it's obvious to anyone with a clear knowledge of what's happening to our global freshwater resources, our leaders do not respond to the fact that our best technological innovations and improvements in practices are ultimately mocked and overshadowed in many cases by relentless population growth and exploding economic development. And what we are seeing now in our time is that interlocking and interpenetrating problems are converging on us faster than our political systems can deal with them. And we find ourselves in a vicious circle where we find ourselves constantly needing to employ ever more complicated and environmentally damaging ways to provide basic human needs. And the environment for which a stimulus package remains to be offered is threatened with bankruptcy in so many parts of the world. So this is not a time to give up on governance. There's been few times in history when we've needed more effective governance, or needed effective governance more than we do now, and our sustainability depends on it. So therefore, I would say in a positive sense that we're lucky in Canada. There's still room to move with respect to our water resources. There's never been a better time to be working in this domain, and there's probably never been a time in our culture when we ought to be reflecting more on what water means to where and how we live. So there's huge opportunities to learn, to put things right, and to even restore some of what has been lost. But we have to act. We have to act here, now, and today.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. It's a good way to end it, though. I'm sure we could talk about water for a little while longer, but that's what the book is for. People should pick up the book, and you can learn a lot more in there. I certainly did. Thanks, Bob, for taking the time to talk with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for the show this week. If you missed part of the interview, or you just want to listen to it again, you can download the show by heading to friendsofbanff.com and clicking the podcast link. Robert William Sanford's new book, Restoring the Flow, will be available next week, and you can pick it up at The Bear and the Butterfly at 214 Banff Avenue. Alpine authors can be heard each week at this time on Park Radio. Tune in next week to hear from another Alpine author.
Alpine authors, only on Park Radio, 101.1 FM.